You're listening to Face Off, Episode 7, recorded February 28th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this show, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us via Twitter at twitter.com/faceoffshow. All right, Mark, we're actually going to just kick the news and follow-ups and just go right into web apps. What do you have for us tonight?
All right, the first one's called Morgue File.
That sounds morbid.
Well, it's kind of, okay, so here's their tagline. Where photo reference lives, public image reference archive.
Oh, okay.
I'm always looking for stock images, royalty-free images that I can use in a project, web design. Maybe I'm not going to use it in my final thing. Maybe I'm just going to throw it into a layout design to
like
show.
Like placeholder stuff?
Yeah, a placeholder. Or maybe I'm going to use it. I don't know. I'm always I don't want to use the Google image search because half the stuff's copywritten and you know blah blah.
Yeah.
Stuff like Stock Exchange, the Stock Exchange the photo exchange. It's called Stock Exchange. So okay. Stock Photo Exchange.
Stock Photo Exchange. Yep.
A lot of those ones are like it's royalty free, but you have to sign up and like exchange credits. Like you'd have to upload some pictures and then exchange your. Then if somebody downloads your picture, you get a credit, and then you can buy credits and things. What this is for. I mean, these are public images. Nobody owns these. You could sell them. I mean, you could do anything you want with them.
Oh, wow,
really?
You could
modify them. Well, if there isn't, all the ones that I saw said that. Like on the bottom, it even says, you feel free to use this.
Okay.
As a corporation, by yourself, modify it. It says you don't have to credit the author or anything.
Oh, okay. So it tells you on a photo-by-photo basis what you can and cannot do with it.
Yes, but I believe if most of them, if not all of them, are all like that, like totally free, public domain style.
All right. So what I did is I went on there and I searched for computer because I always want stock images of computer stuff because we're technology guys. And I found a little picture of an old iMac, I think, from the 90s.
Oh, nice.
But at the bottom it says, Morgue File Free Photo. You are allowed to copy, distribute, transmit the work, and to adapt the work. Attribution is not required. You are prohibited from using this work in a standalone manner. Okay, so I couldn't frame it up and sell that picture, but I can use it in my site. I can modify it if I want. I can, you know, cut it out and put part of it into a different piece of art, and I don't have to give credit to the author. I don't have to, you know, put copyrights everywhere on the picture or anything like that.
That's awesome. Yeah, and like I said, like the stock exchange stuff, you're always looking for stuff, and you don't want to sign up. You don't want to buy credits. You don't, you know. This is a great place to just, this is, and you know, the funny thing is when you go to Google and you search for I want free stock images, you're going to get 20 different sites, but they're all going to be similar. These ones where you have to exchange these images for credits
or just
things.
Pay it's straight not, up. I mean, it's a consortium of artists that want you to pay money to use their photos.
Yeah, it's an ambiguous word. They say it's free, and yes, it's royalty free, but it's not free. I mean, you have to pay for the service to download the images, kind of thing. Where this is, you know, more public domain. I'm looking at it looks like an Apple keyboard, one of the more modern style, though, like the one you have right here.
My aluminum iMac keyboard.
And it looks really professional. Like, this looks very professional.
Good depth of focus and things like that.
I also just downloaded it. The last image I downloaded was over 5 megabytes. So they're huge images. These are like high quality.
Really high quality. Wow, 5 megs.
This one was 2.3.
Was it bitmap? Holy cow.
No, it was JPEG.
Wow.
So let's see how big this is.
Oh, this is cool. So when you do search, though, the one thing that's really handy on the side, I notice, is you can filter by certain things. So I search for computer, but I can on the side I can click filter by rating, and let's say I only want to see ones that are rated, you know, really well, so I can kind of crank that up.
I noticed they did have tags too.
Yeah, tags are a great way to sort of categorize them ad hoc in a really cool fashion. So that's awesome. Apply filters. Unfortunately, there are no highly rated computer photos.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I would consider this one highly rated.
Okay.
I would highly rate it. this one is 2,304 pixels wide by 3,456 high. So, I mean, you could use this for anything.
Wow, there's some good photography on here, too.
Yeah, this one was taken with a Canon EOS Digital Rebel XT. I don't know if that's any good, but it's pretty cool that it tells that.
Okay, so if you're looking for good royalty-free pictures, it's not explicitly Creative Commons or any particular type of copywriting. It's just, the big thing is at least it tells you with each picture what you can do. Like, I just found one that was not free. The owner retained the copyright and wanted attribution and payment for it. But the handy part is it tells you picture by picture, because I know sometimes even with Flickr, you know, it'll tell you there's Creative Commons, but there are lots of little kind of nitpicky things that you can do with Creative Commons that don't tell you what you can do. So this is really nice. It says, hey, straight up, this is what you can do with it. You know, take it, use it however you want, you know. Like the one I found said, you can't frame it and sell it just with the picture itself, but you can use it in another work or another, you know, any other fashion. So
what I like about it, like I said, you don't have to sign up. You don't have to, you know, exchange credits and stuff. In fact, it's the first one I have seen that even does that.
Yeah. So, yeah, the generic free ones kind of, you know, are a little shaky sometimes. You're like, mm-hmm. Well, is this also another site where someone just took someone else's picture and then uploaded it and said, hey, it's free. You can do what you mm-hmm. want with it. So. Cool, morgfile.com.
Very all right, impressive. So the next app we have is WooFoo.
WooFoo. Interesting. So what is WooFoo, Mark?
This is a way to, so it's a way to create a forum that either emails, sends a notification through text. They even, it looks like payments and basically forums, or not forums, forms.
Mm-hmm. Forms. Cool.
Super quick. Like, you fill in a couple things of information, and you copy and paste some code, and it's done for you. You don't have to do the back end or nothing.
Oh, okay.
This is great. I mean, obviously, if you're building a web app, you're gonna have it built in. You're gonna do your own, but this is great for maybe quick things. You know, for a client that wants something really fast. Like, I want, you know, you could set this up in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Like, if you wanted a comment, you know, comment or
like what I see a lot is people, they're like, oh, I just want, you know, a quick survey, you know, or something like that.
Yeah. That
and
kind
I know
of
a
thing.
Lot of places they sign up for something like, I think a service out there is called SurveyMonkey. But this is just quick and free.
And like this thing, it's got it verifies the mobile carrier. Like, yeah, I see for notifications.
Mm-hmm.
You know how Google, if you sign for like Google calendars and things, you can have your events on your calendar text message you,
mm-hmm.
and based on which carrier Google knows how to send it to you, yeah. And things like that.
So this is cool. They do have one big competitor though.
What's that?
Google. Google Apps does this.
Do they?
They have. Yeah, I'm not sure. I work at a university, and right now I know the university version has this. Maybe the public version doesn't. I should look real quick. But, you can – the really cool thing about doing it with Google is that you can then input the results into a Google spreadsheet with one click and integrate it with Google Sites.
Hmm.
So it's something – maybe later we could do sort of a comparison between the two and see which one we like. But this is – I mean, obviously, if Google's doing it, it's a service that people are requesting a lot.
Yeah. You know, basic contact me kind of form. You know, WordPress does some of this stuff, but if you've got a web app that you just or not, I mean, if you're doing a web app, you're gonna do it yourself. But if you just want to do it real quick, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, I mean, a great. Let's say you just you have a community based around a blog or a forum. You're not that's already a third party product. You're not gonna go hack that up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't. I mean, maybe you do if it's something really important, but I don't want to go hack PHP. BB3 to go, you know, to put a contact me form in there. I could just put a link to it there. Or actually, does this link or do you embed it?
I believe you embed it.
Oh, okay.
But it does the back end, I believe. Like, everything's transferred to them or whatever, or yeah. Email. It looks like it's some of the users. It says Best Buy, CNET, Disney, Discovery Channel, Kodak, Microsoft, Nielsen, okay. Twitter.
Is there like a pro version that you pay for then, or
yeah, you get 3 forms for free. You can do whatever you want, and then I believe there's a. Let's see, let's find it. It can actually accept payments, so like PayPal and things.
Oh, Google does not do that.
Well, so they do. They do. Well, they do. Well, no, Google checkout.
Their Google Docs form does not.
Oh,
so that sounds cool. This sounds like a pretty powerful tool. You know, it sounds like that intermediate step between really generic stuff that is obviously Google, like a Google form. You know, I'm going to email this link out to everybody that says Google Docs on it, you know, and then, you know, sort of a build your own, have your developer do it for you thing. It sounds like a really good intermediate step where if maybe you don't want to pay a developer 5 hours to just do one form. You could have these guys do it for you.
Their pricing plans are $9.95. Well, the first one's free for 3 forms, and then $9.95 a month for 10 forms, and you get 20 reports, a maximum amount of fields. You can have as many fields as you want in your form, and it goes up from there. $24.95, you get, you know, unlimited forms and unlimited storage. So, like, you, all the data that's coming back is stored on their servers. You're not storing it.
That's nice.
So there's some advantages to it.
Yeah, I think, I hear so much about SurveyMonkey all the time. I think the university we have has like an institutional wide, license for SurveyMonkey or something. It's something like that. But, this is free. And I have a feeling if you do pay for SurveyMonkey, it's probably expensive. So, and SurveyMonkey's ugly. I'm not impressed.
This site design looks nice.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's a quick way to get a form up. I like I said, I think it's kind of this nice intermediate step between the two things.
Oh, this is nice. So it handles the SSL for you. So if you are doing any secure stuff, it does that. So that's a very good point.
That's a
SSL certificates are very expensive.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on, I guess, to which company you go through and how you know, if you want the fancy green one and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, yeah, they're very pricey for somebody that just wants something like a contact form or something.
Yeah, I mean it.
But then you probably wouldn't have SSL on that.
Oh, maybe, but for my website, I don't have SSL. I just don't need it. So, or if I did have SSL, it would be self-signed. I wouldn't pay for one, which means then I can't send customers to that because you get all the security exceptions and things like that. So,
looks like you really can cool. You can have like files. People can upload files and things. So you don't have to worry about creating a form that is going to have security problems.
Yeah.
Because all the data is going to be over there on their servers anyways. So if there is any, you know, SQL injection, it's going to be on their problem anyways. But
yeah. Well, I'm sure that if this is their service, they probably do some wicked validation.
Oh, yeah.
Probably much better than I could ever do.
So, yeah. So that's another advantage. If you're not very good at making forms and accepting user data and validating it, this is a quick way to just boom.
You know what this sounds a lot like? It sounds a lot like that feedback thing. I can't remember the name of it. We were talking about it a while ago, but it's sort of this. It's sort of like a web application you pay for, but the whole point isn't that you send them to them. It's like a web app that you pay for as a service to put in your own website.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of websites, I've seen this out there now, and I'm sure everyone else out there has seen this. It's a little box on the side that says feedback, and on a lot of sites, it's really distinct.
It's on the left side, left or right side usually, and it pops out if you click on it.
It's on the left or right side. It's on the
far... Well, it's usually on the left, but I have seen it on the right as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it's so on the far side of the browser. It says feedback, and you click in, it kind of slides out this little form and stuff like that. It sounds interesting. It's sort of tools, not like almost... They're not full third-party web applications. They're almost sort of pieces of a third-party web app puzzle,
mm-hmm.
right? If I wanted a feedback thing, I could go get this feedback thing wherever we found it. If I have a form, I can get Woofoo and kind of with all those chunks together have a pretty full-featured website with a lot less development than I normally would have to in the past.
And these guys know what they're doing. That's all they do is develop forms. So these forms are going to be great.
And probably really easy to use for novice users.
Yeah, they're going to already have like the built-in JavaScript validation. Like if you say this field is required and they click on it, it's automatically going
to
do all that
stuff. It's a lot of work to build a backend for something like this for administration, you know, based on you have to have a data type for each question that's going to be asked and then it has to build the form for the person. I think this is a great thing to use.
That feedback thing, I think, is it says it's powered by User Voice.
User Voice, huh? Okay.
So if anybody wants to check that out, we'll probably do another.
We'll talk about it next episode. Yeah. So check it out. It's Woofoo, WUFOO.com for a quick and full-featured form to put on your website. All right, Mark, what do you got next?
All right, so this next one is called Icon Buffet.
Ooh.
This is kind of like the stock images of... You know, like the Mark file, but this is for icons. And these,
ooh, that's awesome.
These are free to use as well, free to collect, trade, and download.
Awesome.
I believe you have to sign up to download, but I'm just looking through here. There's some really nice icons, and you can embed these in your site. You can put them in a program that's a desktop style program. Mm-hmm.
Icons kind of have the thought of being a specific thing, like an icon on your desktop, or even the one that we're most familiar with is the favorite icon that goes up in your address bar or in your favorites.
Sure.
But I mean, icons, everything is an icon. Technically, that little RSS chiclet that you put on your website everywhere is an icon. Anytime, you know, in a menu item, if you put something next to it, it has a little icon next to it. So, I mean, these are a lot of useful things. Here there's kind of it looks like maybe a ripoff. I don't know if I want to say that, of the iTunes podcast icon, like a little dude with headphones and kind of the waves coming off. Mm-hmm. There's an RSS one. There's kind of a nice little error one, you know, the triangle with the exclamation in the middle. So, a lot of little bits that, I mean, maybe if you're a web developer and have been doing it for a long time, you might have your kind of your own corral of icons that you've made yourself wrangled up. But a lot of us aren't that creative, like me for one.
Yeah, or it's a small project and you don't want to like just go spend all your time developing icons and things. You want to just throw something together, you know.
Yeah.
You're more concerned about the back end than the front.
Yeah, exactly. Most of us are, and sometimes we can't hire a designer just to create a small icon for us. I mean, that seems like it might be expensive. So it's got all kinds of icons. I mean, wow. How do we know? I don't know. It has a cart in it. So, I mean, I'm kind of worrying, like, which ones are free?
Well, they have there's a tab on the top that says free delivery.
Oh,
all
okay.
Those ones are free.
Okay.
And then they do have a marketplace.
Okay. Oh, see, like.
So, like, if you were a developer and you created some icons, you could sell them here.
Oh, very cool. But if you go to free right now, they have one that's called Retro Show, which is kind of these almost marshmallowy, bubbly icons of retro gaming things. Like there's a retro ghost from Pac-Man. Oh, there's all the Pac-Man icons right there. Oh, very cool. So these are all free, huh?
Mm-hmm. And so you take this and you take the morgue file and put those together and you've got pretty much everything you need to create something.
Yeah, holy cow. I mean, that's a lot of good free images that you can use in your design.
Mm-hmm. And these are, you don't have to trade or anything for these. You just download them.
Yeah.
This one you do have to sign up, but.
I can live with that. I can sign up for free stuff. What's cool about this is we kind of kept saying design, but a lot of this isn't design. So sometimes if I make a form and I do validation in it and I want, you know, something to happen when, the user inputs a value that isn't acceptable. Normally I'll put, you know, red text in bold, maybe a red box or something, but let's say I just want an icon. I mean, that's not going to be in the design. That's not going to be in the Photoshop file I get from my designer. It's not going to be,
you're going to want like an exclamation warning sign icon or something with some yellow background.
And so maybe I don't want, I mean, it, these are much better than me hacking it out myself in Photoshop. I mean, it would be about as basic as it got if I did it myself. So this is a great way to get, these seem very sort of, you know, web 2.0, glossy, shiny, bubbly-ish. There are some that aren't, but so it fits in really well with sort of the current web trends right now.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Icon Buffet. I suggest everyone check it out. With that mixed with the morgue file.
Yeah, with those two mixed together, you've got all you need to start hacking together some images, create an interface for a web app or a desktop app. I mean, you've got...
Yeah. These are good developer's images, right? When you're a developer, you need just an image for a placeholder or you need an image to put in your thing that maybe the designer didn't put. You're going to need icons. These aren't the sort of thing I would send a graphic designer to because I'm sure they have their own means. But for as a developer, these are just images that you're going to need and you don't have to pay for or give, you know, royalty to or credit to or anything like that.
Yep. So very check that cool out. It's iconbuffet.com.
Okay. So let's get into the meat, Mark. We got, we just had our appetizers. Let's get into dinner. Our first topic is a really good one, and I'm going to give it to you to take away with it here in a sec. But it's using OpenID and VeriSign, what would you call them? We know them as the PayPal secure key.
Yeah, the fob as they call them. I don't know what that stands.
The football. But
it's a, yeah, so go ahead.
Okay, so I mean, one of the cool things you can do on PayPal right now is if you pay $5, you can get this little PayPal football. We call it the football because it's football shaped. And what this does is it allows you to assign this football to your PayPal account. And the only way to log into your PayPal account is to put in your username and password and then push a button on this little device that gives you a six digit numeric code.
Right.
And you have to put that code in or else you can't log in.
Right. And that code is changing every single time you press the button.
Yeah. This is known as multi-factor authentication. Mm-hmm. Mark and I are big multi-factor authentication fans. We talk about this a lot. We're doing some multi-factor authentication things in other projects. But so you and I initially got these because we like PayPal and we like multi-factor authentication. And we were like, oh, cool. It's pretty much exclusively useful for PayPal. Fun. But it turns out it's not, right?
Right. Okay, so if you were to so VeriSign has had these things out for years. Companies that have their employees logging in remotely, they're going to use a device like this, something that's you want to super secure.
To clarify, if I can, the PayPal one is just a rebranded VeriSign key thing.
Okay, so yeah. First of all, let me tell you about the advantages of multi-factor authentication.
Oh, please do.
If somebody is either key logging or watching what you're doing on the keyboard somehow, either behind you, a key logger, maybe they're looking at your session, your packets, they can see and they see your password, they can take that password and your username and log into a site.
Yep.
Okay.
That is single factor authentication.
Single factor.
It's your username and password, one factor. We talk about the three factors?
Sure.
The three factors are what you are, what you know, and what you have.
Okay.
So what you are is you. I already messed it up.
Go ahead. No, you're doing good at it.
Okay, so what you know, right? That's easy. Username and password, that's the most common mm-hmm. method of authentication out there. I know my username and password. You know, okay, so the other one is what you have. And this keychain is what you have. It's a device right. on you. It could be a key card that you swipe to get into a building. It could be, you know, a key thing to log into a building, but it's something that you have on you that is separate from what you know.
So let's say somebody did see my password somehow, either through whatever means possible. They cannot get into my account, even with my password and username, without this device. Mm. And even if I tell you, I'm going to tell you right now over the air, the device right now is telling me 453745. Mm-hmm. Now, if I type my username and password with that, it would log me in right now. Mm-hmm. But in about 2 or 3 seconds from now, it's going to change, and that number is going to be totally worthless. Mm-hmm. That number will probably never, ever come up again on this device.
Mm-hmm. So the third is what you are, and that's things like handprint scans, retinal scans. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, at the gym at Montana State University, they have a thing now where you scan your handprint and then you also have to enter in your student ID separately. So that is multi-factor authentication. It's what you are, my hand, and then what I know, my student ID, and I punch it in.
Another good example is multi-factor authentication doesn't have to be totally unique. Like, sometimes what they'll do is they'll say, what's your name? Give me a picture identification. And then they'll measure from the base of your palm to the tip of your finger or something. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now there's probably a bunch of people with the same measurement.
Yeah.
But there's probably going to be a lot less. I mean, if somebody grabbed your ID or something and they tried to use it mm-hmm. and then they got their hand measured and it was totally off, they'd know, you know, it was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So that's kind of how it works. And banks are kind of doing this with these images. When you log in, it's like select your image and there's like a group of 10 images or something and you're the whatever you're the, you know, and you click on your image and it logs in. If somebody else used your username and password and then they had to guess what image that was, they click it and they'd probably mm-hmm. get it wrong and they'd have a 1 out of 10 chance or whatever.
Yeah. And that's only if they pass the first authentication measure.
Right.
This is the beauty of multi-factor.
So what this is great for is if somebody does get your password, so like over the air, keylogger, virus, worm, spyware, maybe it's they brute forced it, whatever. This mm-hmm. is what this is going to prevent that.
Yeah.
You cannot log in without this device. Or I guess the other thing would be is if somebody figured out the algorithm for this and they knew your serial number on the device, mm-hmm. but that it's VeriSign.
Yeah. I mean, let's say you left this let's say you left this on your little PayPal key on a bench somewhere and someone got it and they're like, oh, well, now I can get into this person's PayPal thing. It's no good.
You still don't know their password.
Yeah, you don't know the username and password, so you're safe.
And this, my device at least, I don't put my name on it. So if I did lose this, somebody would pick it up and say, what the heck is this?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly.
You know, so it's okay. Really cool. So the VeriSign one,
$5.
The VeriSign one normally is around $30, I believe.
Yep.
They have a more expensive model that's about a credit card size. It's in the shape and the size of a credit card, so you can put it in your wallet. It's mm-hmm. a little bit more convenient. PayPal, as far as I understand it, is basically subsidizing this. They're yeah. saying if you want multi-factor authentication, basically just pay shipping of like $5 yeah. and we will send you this little device.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so you're saying, okay, I don't use PayPal, or maybe I don't use PayPal very much. What else can I do with
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we thought when we first got it. We were like, okay, the PayPal is cool. I know my PayPal is secure, which is nice because people can send money. Mm-hmm. But I mean, for me, I don't carry it around with me everywhere. It's in my, you know, it's maybe near me at all times. But I mean, it's not in my wallet. It's not on my keychain because I log into PayPal, you know, once a week.
Mm-hmm. So the first thing is PayPal or eBay and PayPal are the same, you know.
Yep.
What is it? eBay owns PayPal? Yep. Or, yeah. Okay. So if you want, you can log in. If you have an eBay account, you can log in with this.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, that's the first thing.
That's cool.
That's a little bit better.
Yeah, okay? It makes it a little more useful.
A little bit more useful. Now, there's also OpenID. Now, VeriSign Labs, so the URL is PIP, so it's Personal Identity Portal, .verisignlabs.com. And what this is it's an OpenID provider. So what you can do is you can use this $5. Okay, and since this is a PayPal device,
mm-hmm.
that's basically it's branded VeriSign device. You can use this PayPal device through this VeriSign personal identity.
Okay, so they're not cutting off the PayPal ones that they have branded.
No, it's they're not saying, oh, this is a PayPal VeriSign device.
So you can't use it.
You can't use this. You got to buy a different one. No, this works
it's
there
the
too.
Same device.
It's the same exact device. So this $5 device is normal that would normally be $30. You can get it through PayPal for $5.
Okay.
And I would recommend checking that out. And PayPal is an awesome service too.
So what is OpenID?
Okay. Well, what this personal identity portal does is it works with OpenID. What OpenID is that it's a place where you can log in to all these different sites through your own, what you choose.
Yeah.
The identity provider that you choose.
So instead of signing up for, you know, a million accounts, having a million different usernames, a million different passwords, if a website supports OpenID, usually you have to register anyways, but you register and then you say, okay, well, I want to log in using my OpenID. It says, okay, what's your OpenID? All those sites that have OpenID, I can use the same username and password to log into. So, you know, Jade Robbins at myopenidprovider.com can log me into, you know, Facebook, Mint, you know, if they support OpenID.
And we've been talking about OpenID in a lot of the apps that we've been talking about in the last few podcasts. Yep. Snipped is one of them. You know, there's just... I think we mentioned, go back to the other podcast and that we mentioned if it was OpenID. Yeah,
I think a lot of the big frameworks now have built in OpenID support, which is
WordPress
awesome.
Even does.
Oh, love WordPress.
And OpenID, I mean, it's open source, isn't it? I mean, anybody can do it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's an open standard.
So you could even include this in your own web app that you're creating.
So, okay. So I go to this VeriSign Labs personal identity portal. I sign up for an OpenID account and I associate my PayPal key to that OpenID account.
Correct.
So, you know, I go to all these various websites with OpenID support, you know, and I go in and I log in and what do I see?
So you put your username and password and then it's going to ask you for your multi-factor authentication. It's going to ask you for a 6-digit number.
Okay, the 6-digit number that I get from my little PayPal key there.
Yeah, so when it says put in your 6-digit number, you click this button and you type it in and you hit enter.
Okay.
Now that button is going, or that number, like I said, is going to change every time. So that number, once I've used, I mean, I could tell it right now again, 078115. Yep. 3 seconds later, it's going to be gone.
Okay.
So somebody sniffing the password, watching over your shoulder, whatever, there's nothing they can do with it.
No good. They can't in 3 seconds later unless they have that device with them.
And they know the username and password.
So it's really funny. I mean, getting away from sort of just the OpenID fact of it, I mean, the only other things I've ever seen that use this are PayPal, eBay, you know, these the VeriSign one, and World of Warcraft.
Yeah, World of Warcraft instituted the same thing. They use VeriSign, don't they?
I believe so. It looks the exact same.
Same thing, yep.
But here's the funny part. So, I mean, World of Warcraft, PayPal, and eBay are just leap years ahead in security than any bank I've ever seen right now. My bank does not use this, and I use three different banks, and not a single one uses anything like this at all.
Yep. Why? I don't know. I mean, they've got a picture. I mean, you could select one out of 10 pictures, but how secure is that compared to this? It's way better.
So, I mean, the implication of this, though, is that while it used to only be PayPal, eBay, you know, maybe some VeriSign sites, now any site with OpenID is just way more secure.
And instead of for $30, if you do it through PayPal, it's only $5.
Only for five that bones, dude.
It's pretty much worth it. I love mine. It's fun.
Yeah, I mean, you and I, we message our keys back to each other every day just for fun. Because the second Mark and I see a six-digit, you know, number, we know exactly what that means instantaneously.
And, I mean, it's great because you don't have to, you know how a lot of security guys will tell you to change your password every couple months and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, with this, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I could give you, I mean, I'm not gonna, that's right. Not sound security policy, but I could give you my username and password right now to, PayPal or any OpenID site that I signed up with this.
Get in.
Good luck.
Unless I root around in your bag and get your thing. But so
that's really cool. I mean, that's...
And with OpenID, once you log in with one site, you can log in any of the other or all the other sites will be already logged in for you on that computer for a while.
Yeah, once you log in with this sort of RSA OpenID cookie, I don't know if it's a cookie, but chunk. It recognizes that when you go to other sites, and you don't have to get your little keychain out every time you log in.
Yeah, so everything that's OpenID, you're logged in already.
Awesome. Yep. That's really cool. I think that's a great tip, especially, I mean, for some of the people listening to this show, you know, they might not want to use it themselves, but this is a great tip to give to other people. I wish more things use multi-factor authentication. I'm kind of trying to push at work. There's this really great product out called YubiKey. And it's basically the same thing as this, except for instead of six-digit characters, it has, I think, you know, like a 250-long string of random characters, which would normally be a pain in the butt to enter. But with YubiKey, you stick it into your USB port, and it pretends that it's a keyboard, and you push the button on it, and it types it in for you. So it's even more secure, because not only, you know, maybe some weird chance someone could figure out or brute force a six-digit code, maybe, right? But with YubiKey, it's not six numbers. It's a ridiculously long string.
And it's more convenient because you press a button instead of literally, you know, well, you still press a button on this, but you have the transcode, you know.
Yeah, you have to type it in still. Yeah.
With this, it types it in for you.
And YubiKey, actually, if you get it, it comes with its own OpenID service as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, and API, I believe, is open source, too. So you can integrate YubiKey stuff in your own
stuff. And so, I mean, if you create your own little YubiKey OpenID service, let's say, you know, I wanted to make one for JadeRobbins.com. So everywhere I logged into, I could do jade@jaderobbins.com. It would go to jaderobbins.com, get the OpenID information, and then I could use my YubiKey anywhere there's OpenID without using another company.
So just like this.
Yeah.
The other thing that's nice about OpenID is when you log off, it logs off all the sites.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So if you're on a public computer, you log off once and everything's gone.
Yeah. I get in trouble with this at work sometimes when I present because I log into a couple different things while I'm presenting. And then when you're done with a meeting, you know, you're like, oh, okay, I'm just done. And you leave. And then the next day we have a meeting and I go back and I'm logged into everything on my computer and I feel like
What if you log into five different things? You log out of your email, but you forget to log out of Snipped or something. It's kind of, with this, you just log out of everything that supports it.
That's cool.
So the more programs that support it, the better, obviously.
Yeah, I wish more things supported OpenID. It was a big initiative, I think, a little while ago, and then it kind of lost steam, but it seems to be picking up more and more. I think as programmers like you and I become conscious of it, we kind of make sure that our applications support it as much as possible.
And then the only other thing I wanted to mention was that Steve Gibson is a huge multi-factor authentication, and this is where I found out about it. So
yeah, he's the host of Security Now, another really cool podcast.
Yeah, from check that the out. Twit Network. Definitely,
I'm sure people know of Steve Gibson.
True.
Cool. So I would suggest everybody, you know, go to PayPal, pay $5 for it instead of $30 from VeriSign, and get to multi-factor authenticating to as much stuff as you can. It's really actually, to bring it back there, it's easy to see things that have OpenID because they have kind of this little logo. It says in orange OpenID, and it's kind of an eye with a little gray circle around it. So wherever you see that, you can log in with OpenID.
And for $5, it's worth it.
Very much worth it. All right, Mark. So the next thing we're going to talk about, Mark, you really like SEO, search engine optimization. You're mm-hmm. really into it. You know a lot more about it than I do. So I wanted to talk about this because I think it's going to be really interesting for you and for our listeners as well. So to kind of it's talking about a canonical tag, okay. Which
now I've talked about this on my blog a little bit about the www versus non, and so, and this is a little bit different. This is news. This just came out as far, you know, a few days ago.
Yeah.
So,
and basically it's kind of just a way, with one of the big problems of SEO is duplicate content. Like even, you know, WordPress blogs, mm-hmm. you know,
WordPress has a ton of duplicate content on default installed.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you go to a categories page, it's listing, you know, exactly what you want to do, all the posts in a various category. But Google looks at that and says, but you're trying to make your content show up more than other people's. So that's duplicate content, and it gives you a little demerit on your search engine.
Yeah.
Rankings.
Well, and it's mainly for like sidebars and things that really are duplicate content, menus, menu navs and stuff. Google wants to say that information is not relevant to the search, you know, mm-hmm. which it should, because then, you know, the sidebars and the navs that doesn't have anything to do with the article.
Yeah. So what this canonical tag does is it kind of lets you say within your website what is the authoritative address is. So I'm going to play a little snippet of this video from Matt Cutts, who is a big guy at Google that we've talked about before, mm-hmm. kind of explaining why this is good and how it works and why it's important now is the big thing. So here it goes.
And so wouldn't it be nice if there was an extra way that you could resolve some of that duplicate content worry? Well, there is as of today, and it's supported by Google and Yahoo and Microsoft. They're adding support for it as well. It's very simple. It's a page-level tag, and you edit the head of the HTML document, and you say, okay, here's my URL. Maybe this is an ugly URL. You have and sort by equals descending, sort by equals ascending, session ID equals whatever, tracking code equals whatever, UTM equals, you know, for analytics. There's all these ugly URLs. You can say in the head of that document, the pretty, the preferred, the primary, the canonical version of this URL is over here.
All right. So this is really cool. And I think in either this video or another video that I saw about it, he talks about browser support as well. I think browsers have supported this along for a while. They tend to be, you know, somewhat quicker with things like that than things like search engines. But so it also will kind of, your browser has support for knowing what the authoritative address is.
Okay, so for example, in WordPress, if you had he mentioned WordPress, which I thought was cool.
Yeah.
With the WordPress, you've got, you know, post question mark equals. You can get to it that way. That's like the hard address. That's the that's the actual.
The non, what do they call it? The non sort of pretty address.
It hasn't been mod rewritten with Apache to make it look like it's in a directory structure.
Mm-hmm.
But what you could do is you could take that and put the snippet into the head of that and say, this is not what I want you to use. I want you to use the permalink is what WordPress mm-hmm. calls it.
Yeah, because your CMS spits out the same code no matter what, you know, mm-hmm. with the same address. But the address does change. So this little tag says, you know, when you go to, you know, post question mark post equals 125, you look, this little canonical tag says, no, what I want this to be is slash, you know, post category slash post title.
And this helps get rid of a lot of the duplicate content stuff. I know in my blogs in the past, I always tell robots.txt, which is an exclusion, where you can exclude bots. You say, you know, don't go here. Mm-hmm. Or you can say, you can go here and you can look around, but don't store this.
Mm-hmm.
This is useful for searches and archive pages because a lot of times by default, the WordPress keeps your entire post or even the more section of in the archive.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is you get a lot of duplicate content penalties by Google. So your posts are getting worthless as far as information ranking.
Yeah, exactly.
With this, it's like, no. So here's a little piece of the article, but it's actually, here's the original. This is the piece I want you to rank the high, you know?
Yeah, exactly. This is, you're almost kind of telling them up front, like, just so you know, this is duplicate content. And this, the real address is here. So, you know, don't penalize me for this. I'm letting you know ahead of time that this is duplicate content.
And I think this is a great thing. I'm going to start implementing it right away.
Yeah, I think I am too.
I think it's a good move because there is a lot of this. It gets kind of frustrating when you try to move. Let's say you change the permalink structure or whatever. You can easily change this little tag and boom.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's going to help out a lot.
And the other thing you mentioned, which is really important, is it's supported by Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo.
That's all you need.
Those are the big three right there.
If they do it, the other search engines will follow suit.
Oh, yeah, in no time. So you know, it's not one of these. I mean, sometimes out there, you notice we all kind of focus on Google. I know I do, at least, because I think that's the primary search engine out there. But it's good to know that sometimes, at least, they can work together.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get rid of that duplicate. And think about it. In WordPress, this is so easy. In your template, you just put a tag, and you just say canonical link equals, you know, permalink, the permalink that you already set up for the article.
Mm-hmm. So this is big news. If you're into SEO at all, you need to check this out.
Yeah, you should be checking it out
and use it.
Yeah, really cool.
So, all
right. So speaking of Google, the next thing that I'm going to have you talk about, Mark, is the Google Webmaster Tools.
Okay, so the Google Webmaster Tools, he's been around a little bit. If you don't know about them, though, you definitely need to check these out. There's some awesome things you can do with this. It's google.com/webmasters, or webmaster works too. As soon as you go here, there's a lot of things you can check out. You can see when the last time Google crawled your sites.
Oh, that's handy.
You can see if there was any HTTP errors from the Google side of things. Obviously, you can check your web stats, your logs.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what Google's bots are seeing, okay? So if somebody linked to your site from somewhere else and they used the wrong link or whatever, it's going to come in there and say, we couldn't find this page. This is an error.
Yeah.
And you can take that information and you can write 301 redirects to the actual page and you can transfer some of that page rank from that link, the person that linked to you.
Oh,
so you
nice.
Need to be checking this out.
Yeah, I mean, like I logged into mine and I'm looking at jaderobbins.com and there's a lot of unreachable URLs that stemmed from my old blog when I moved to WordPress.
Yeah, so in that case, if you wanted some of those articles to transfer over to the new blog, you'd go in here and you'd look at the errors that you're generating. You'd go in and write a redirect for each one of those. You'd transfer it to the actual. You'd have to do some, you know, some manual, you know, translation in there.
Yeah.
But it would be worth it.
So
because
like
you're
going
to get the page rank from your old site transferred to the new one if you do 301 redirects.
So, I mean, I had a couple popular things that I wrote, like some school papers and things like that. I probably, especially the big ones that are getting a lot of hits, I should go in and 301 those.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you have a really popular article that's getting a lot of hits, like you said. Last podcast we talked about robots.txt was something you don't want to accidentally block something on your site.
Yeah.
This thing's awesome. They have a tool here that will show you the URLs that were restricted by the robots.txt for Google.
Oh, okay.
So if you do accidentally have some line in there that says like deny all or something like an accident and Google's not indexing your site, it's going to show you each URL that it tried to get to, but it said the robots.txt denied it. So here it
is. That's nice. So, I mean, you can kind of look and say, all right, well, this is doing what I intended for it to do. You know, I can see it's not looking at my categories. It's not looking at my tags. It's not looking at this. It's looking just at the index list and each individual article.
Right.
Good. I did it right.
Yeah, so that's incredibly handy for people that, you know, if you accidentally made a mistake. Another great thing is you can actually download a table of all the sites that are, like, broken, like the errors, into, like, a CVS or, you know, so you could actually run a script to help fix that kind
of
stuff. Like, if you had
instead
a huge
doing
site
manually, like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, like 4,000 articles, you could do something with that. They have a robots.txt analyzer, so you could actually put in a robots.txt and say, what URLs would you have excluded?
Oh, wow.
Go right now.
That's really cool.
And then it'll go and check.
So you can tweak it and see what you like and what you don't.
Sure. Some of the other things. We talked to, well, I've talked about it on my blog about WWW versus non-WWW, and my, Matt Cutts talks about it in this video that you just played earlier on in the video.
It'll be in our show notes, too.
The show notes. Normally, a search engine used, well, they what they normally do, and I think they still kind of do today, is if you have www site, www.yourdomain.com, and you have http://yourdomain.com without the www.
In a link?
In a link. Google will think those two pages are different. Two separate pages with the exact same content. Okay. So you're getting a duplication penalty.
Okay. Because like I know we both use DreamHost, and with DreamHost, you can change that to... I cut off all www dot. So even if you do go to www dot, it just goes whoop, and redirects you to just
right.
Without
and that's video. Probably good enough. The other thing you could check though is people linking to you. So yeah. Sometimes have the HTTP. What Google allows you to, they know that. I mean, this is. I think they've pretty much gotten around it. It's not a big deal anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But what they've done to alleviate that a little bit is you can actually tell them which one you prefer. And they list your site in their search index, they will add the www or they'll take it off, depending on your preference.
Oh, that's really nice. I mean, because like I just prefer
not having it.
Yeah, not having it. Just a weird preference for that particular site.
When I set up marksanborn.net, I had the www in there on purpose. And so I've set it in my preferences here. And then every time they show it, it'll have the www.
Awesome.
And by doing that, they will not duplicate. They will not penalize the other one. They know that you prefer this one.
That's nice, too. So it knows not to penalize it because that is a problem.
So you're going to want to go check that on your sites and set it accordingly to what you're using already. What else does it have? It has a content analysis. You can check out the crawl, the actual data that the web crawler found on your site.
Oh, is this kind of like, I mean, I've seen these out on the web for a while now. It kind of says, see your website as a search bot sees it.
It's funny that you say that. Google will actually tell you to use links. They'll say, check your site out in links. That's what
really?
Yeah,
the console
literally say that.
Web browser links. Yeah.
They say that's what our bot sees.
That's awesome.
So if you ever want to know, just pop open links. But you can see their content analysis. They will actually tell you how many duplicate title tags you have. So if you use Mark's blog as every single title for everything, your articles and everything.
Yeah.
You're not going to rank well, and they're going to tell you. They're going to say you have 18 duplicate titles, and they'll tell you the URLs that have the duplicate titles, so you can go in there and fix them. They'll tell you the ones you have missing title tags. So, like, if you don't have a title on one of your articles on one of your pages or whatever, you can find that.
That's nice.
They even have a thing called a non-informative title, where it's just it has nothing to do with the keyword density, like the keywords that are in that article or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helpful. They have a sitemap feature where you can actually upload what you think your site hierarchy should be, and they will take that. They don't. It's not like a set in stone thing.
Uh-huh.
So like you can actually put weight on certain pages.
Oh, that's nice.
With the sitemap.
I mean, yeah, because let's say on, jaderobbins.com, I have a link to my webcam, which is just a Ustream thing, but when people search for Jade Robbins, I don't want that to come up in my sitemap by default. You know, I want my projects and my blog to be by default on the sitemap, and kind of weigh those more than webcam.
Right. And with the sitemap, you can, with the Google sitemap and the other search engines support this as well. But yeah, you can weight it.
Okay. So
it's like, not set in stone though. Like if you say my homepage should be a 1.0 and everything else should be 0.9, Google can, they can do their own thing.
Well, let's say,
but it's a suggestion.
Yeah. Google, or let's say WordPress, there are some plugins that generate a XML sitemap for you automatically. That's all well and great, but let's say I have, I'm working for Philip Morris or something like that, and on my link to the website I have, products and cool, promotions, and then a little tiny link at the bottom that is like, information for people, who are gonna sue us. I don't want that to show up in my sitemap, even though it is part of my site. I want my good stuff, so I can weight those and kind of say, maybe even make that a zero.
Yeah, typical like a typical WordPress, you'd have your articles pretty high. Mm-hmm. You'd have your archive pages and categories lower, and your front page a little bit higher than those.
Okay.
That's about it.
Cool.
Maybe pages would be a little bit higher than articles.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so much stuff. I can look at all the links on my website. I can see links that are external. I can see all my internal links. Maybe I have some internal links that are broken, or like you said, I kind of want to see the structure of how I link internally to make sure I link correctly.
Yeah.
I can do that.
You can see the top search queries. You can see what Googlebot sees. It looks like they have that. Yeah.
So, I mean,
you can change the crawl rate too.
Oh.
But you can't make it faster.
Okay.
It's slower. You can slow if you want to slow it down.
So, I mean, let's say you're developing and you're like, I don't want you to crawl every 2 minutes.
A lot of times, I think what it is to limit the load. Because if Google's hitting your site, like a dig or something, then Google's hitting your site every 5 minutes, you know.
Okay. Oh, so that's a great example where Google calculates that your site is really popular and it needs to scan it a lot. And you're like, well, you're getting a little too comfortable with me, Google. Back off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's about limiting the bandwidth on your server. What if it becomes a problem? Hopefully it does.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, wow, there's a lot of cool stuff here. People really need to look at it.
It's been out for a long time. It's just even me looking at it back now, I need to go check out some of my URLs. I see that I have a few that I could fix up a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even know about it. I mean, this is the thing I found with Google is they offer so many services. And even within each service, there are so many little things that it is hard to keep up. I mean, I got digging a little bit into AdSense the other day, and they have so many new tools for AdSense to analyze how you want your ads displayed, kind of what kind of stuff you want.
They're always adding stuff, too.
Oh, yeah. It's just ridiculous. You can't keep up with it. And I mean, I don't think that's a terrible thing that they're adding so many services that, you know, I'm slacking off and not paying attention. But you've got to watch Google. You got to keep your eye on it because they are doing stuff all the time.
Yep. And you can also, I mean, all the sites are going to be in the one spot, too. So that's cool. You can have all your sites in one.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
All right.
What else we got next?
So the next thing I want to talk about is this little article I found on Smashing Magazine called 10 Harsh Truths About Corporate Websites. And, the gamut of people who are listening, it can kind of go both ways. If you're just kind of a developer working, this might not be for, you know, a web entrepreneur developer with a small company. This might not be the article for you. But a lot of us are developers working in this corporation. And a lot of us are web developers in this corporation. So here's some things that you need to at least recognize and try and, you know, mitigate some of these problems right away. So I'm going to hit the list and we can kind of talk about them as we go. So number one, you need a separate web division. And like I said, the language in this is they say division, but what this basically means is you need a dedicated web person. Maybe not even 100% of their time dedicated, but you need someone who you say, hey, your job is to watch our web presence in some form or fashion. Number two, managing your website is a full-time job.
Yep.
Which we'll get back to that. But number three, periodic redesign is not enough. Redesigning your web page once every 10 years is not enough, especially in the dynamic web of today. Number four is your website cannot appeal to everyone. This is kind of a problem a lot of people see where they want it to look. They want everyone to like their website, and what you need to realize is you need to focus on your core demographic and make your website for them. Number five is you are wasting money on social networking. And this is good because we really like social networking, but if you do it wrong, it hurts you way more than it helps you. Like we've seen the Twitter accounts that we know are not genuine, that are, you know, are always just really sort of pre-pressed, you know, public relations things that just don't seem genuine, and that doesn't fit in the social world. So number six is your website is not all about you. And this is a really good point because a lot of companies, you know, it's just all them all the time. But at the same time, if your customers are there and you're providing a service, you're an expert at something, which doesn't always relate to you. You're an expert in you, but if you're a financial services company, you're an expert in financial services. And maybe you need to help your website visitors look at financial services as a whole, not just, you know, Jade Robbins Financial Services. Number seven is you're not getting value from your web team. This basically says that a lot of companies fail to fully utilize their web people by not listening to them. You know, when the web people tell them, use their expertise to give them a good suggestion, and then they don't listen to it, which happens quite a bit. Number eight is design by committee brings death. This happens everywhere. I mean, we're seeing it at work right now. We're having a problem with, especially you see it a lot of government contracts and stuff like this, mm-hmm. where there's not one single point of contact for the web designer to get a hold of. So you have eight different bosses telling you eight different things, and you can never please them all. So that's never the way to go. Number nine, a CMS is not a silver bullet. And this is a really good point, because a lot of people think, if I just get a CMS, everything's going to work great. No. And there's a lot more to it. And number 10 is that you have too much content. And this is a huge problem in a bigger organization. I know, like at Montana State University, there is content there that is 15 years old. That is still, because we use a Google search for our search. So of course Google's going to find it. And there's just so much old stuff out there that it's either wrong or confusing or just completely irrelevant. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
All right. So let's dive into these a little bit more.
Okay.
Which one? So the one I noticed real quick is you're not getting your value from the web team. A little bit of seven, a little bit of eight, which was so the first one was you're not getting value from your web team, and eight was designed by committee brings death. Now, here's the thing: when you're talking to your client and they're like, "I want this and that," and you explain to them, "Hey, that's kind of okay. I understand where you're going with it, but that's not how the web is moving right now. That's not the current trend to have this bright orange color, or like, you know what I'm saying?"
Mm-hmm.
And like they were saying, they don't trust your instincts about, you're designing websites, you're the designer, you see websites, good looking websites, successful websites all the time. And these small companies, they think that they've got this idea, but I don't know. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's, again, this article is sort of focused towards someone. It doesn't sound like it's focused for someone who is hired as an outside consultant. It sounds like someone who's working for a web team in a company. And especially in that situation, when you're hiring someone outside, you're kind of saying, no matter what, the client can say, that your opinion's great, but I'm paying you, so do it.
True.
When you have kind of a team inside your company whose job is to be the web people, even then you need to, even then, still the even same. More, you, yeah, it is the same, but that's when you really need to trust them. You're not just hiring them for a one-time job. They're hired there all the time to be your web expert. So you really need to trust their decisions then.
But this is funny, because I got asked, it was like, "Oh, let's have a car zip by and have some audio playing when the..." No, we're not doing that. Yeah. Just trust me on this.
It's tough. This article also, I think it kind of goes both ways. Maybe this is kind of one of those things you might say, like, "Hey, send to the guys upstairs to take a look at so that they know what they're doing wrong," because in any environment, your customer can do this. You know, if your customer is your boss or your customer is an actual customer, they can just come on and really put the axe to it and say, "Well, you know, I don't care."
That's got to be really frustrating to a designer.
Oh,
that like puts his heart and soul into something and then he's like, "Change these colors to this nasty color."
Yeah,
and
it's a really funny thing with the web for some reason. Companies look at it and think that it's so easy and simple that they don't really need to listen to their experts on it. You know, a company doesn't get financial advice internally unless they have experts in it, right? I mean, I'm not going to go to a bakery and go talk to one of the bakers in the back about financial, you know, consulting for the company, because they're not experts in it. But for some reason, this gets lost in the web with a lot of people. They think, "Well, I surf the web every day, so I know what is out there. I mean, I don't need, there's no such thing as a web expert. A web expert is a 17-year-old who surfs Facebook all day. You know, I go to all my websites every day, you know, the three websites that the guy goes to, Yahoo and Google, and then maybe, you know, Scott Trade or something like that. And he's like, I know what a good website is. And
okay, yeah. So, and then there's the other one is you're wasting money on social networking. I think a lot of companies don't understand it. And they're putting the Dig widget or the Reddit widget on their site just because everybody else is. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, we got to get this content. Look, Dig pulls in all this traffic. We got to put this on our website. Yet they don't understand it.
Yeah. Oh.
So they spend tons of money on it, and they make viral videos, and they try to.
There's so many companies out there that put the Dig widget on their corporate blog that is totally useless for Dig. Why would anybody dig a little two paragraph blog post about something that you're putting out that is completely not exciting? Why would anybody dig that? That makes no sense. And there's another good one. You said viral videos. And the funny thing is with those is the internet can sniff those out in 2 seconds flat, and they will mark it as fake, and you are off the radar. Mm-hmm. Never again.
Yeah, it's kind of a lost treasure. So you're not going to get those anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's another one that I kind of like is realign, not redesign.
Yeah,
I remember reading this. It's funny that they showed this article, this A-List Apart article, because I remember reading this back in 2005. There's a date on there.
I remember
reading this, and I realized it's 2005. You'd never want to totally redesign your site. You want to, because then
morph.
You never want to totally just change it all. You want to fix it or improve it.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
You don't want the user to go there and be like, "Where? How do I get around now?"
Yeah.
The navigation's changed. Everything's changed. So the user gets confused. Yeah.
Or like, is there a big shakeup at this company? Did they get bought out by someone?
It's a really good read. Check that out. You don't want to confuse your readers by just totally changing everything.
So the one I want to talk about is a CMS is not a silver bullet, because I saw this really awesome quote on Twitter the other day about this from a guy named WebDav on there. And he says, it's like a dictionary definition. It says, content management system, web-based solution to allow clients and users to screw up their own website without professional help. And that's so true. I mean, a lot of companies, they think, well, once we get a CMS up, it's going to be really easy to change our website. But that doesn't make it good. That's why you need experts to know what they're doing. There was a big shakeup where I work at Montana State University with the College of Engineering, because they implemented Drupal. And they did the branding like they were supposed to. They used the MSU header and everything like that. But all their links and their text were this bright green and bright red and bright blue that just did not fit the template at all. Mm-hmm. They liked it, and maybe some other people might like it. But I know from talking to people that they were like, "Whoa, that is not pretty." Mm-hmm. And so it's like that sort of thing where they set it up that we have a CMS with a template that's branded just like we're supposed to, but they still got it wrong because it's not just the ability to change it that makes it good. You have to look at your whole website as a brand, as a whole, and say, what can I do, instead of just saying I can do.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
So that's a really cool article. It's just some tips for people to make sure they don't do things that make their website look bad in the end, because really the whole goal of it is to do good things.
All right, and you got a quick little tip for the SEO, just to finish this off here?
Well,
The
best SEO tip of all. I mean, everybody always asks, what's a good SEO tip? How can I improve my SEO ranking? The best tip for SEO is to have good content. I mean, if you have good content, and I mean, unless you're purposefully screwing up your search engine results, they'll find you, and your users will find you, and your users will link to you, which will increase your page rank, which will help out. And everyone is always like, well, what can I do to increase my Google ranking? And it's cheating. You're cheating if you're going to try and find ways to get around it. If you don't have the good content, you shouldn't be on there in the first place. If I'm searching for something and you cheated to get yourself in that search result, you're not helping me. You're not helping a consumer, and you're not helping yourself, because you look like jerks.
Well, there's ways to improve your search engine indexability to a point, but there's things like inlinks. People mm-hmm. linking to you that you can't fake.
Yeah, or you hear people do this all the time. Well, like, meta keywords were the big thing back in the day, and they became useless because everyone, of course,
just gonna put it.
I'm a web development company, and you're like, what is my site about? Britney Spears. You know, because But that doesn't help anybody. That's cheating. The best thing you can do is put out good work that people will enjoy, and it will happen to you by itself.
Yeah. See, if you have good content, people are going to link. If you get links, you get higher page rank. If you get higher page rank, everything goes up.
You get better word of mouth because people say, hey, you know, Bill, check this out. This is cool. I mean, and in the end, it will come to you. You don't have to seek it out aggressively.
All right.
All right.
That about wraps it up.
Yeah, that wraps up for this episode of Face Off Show. We'd like to remind you can subscribe to our show at faceoffshow.com/feed. If you have any suggestions or comments or anything, you can send them to studio@faceoffshow.com or reply to us on Twitter at @faceoffshow or leave a comment on the episode on the blog. We love feedback. This is always a learning experience with Mark and I, and we know we're not perfect. And if you have any suggestions or anything to help us out, we love that. We'd love to hear from you guys.
And even send an audio clip too if you got one.
Yeah, just attach it to an attachment at Google. We'd love to play people's questions on the air or suggestions or anything. So, we will see you next week.